first case scheduled for today, Mann v. Vogel, will be taken on the briefs, and we will proceed to the second case on the calendar for today, Schultz v. Glidden. Mr. Castor? Oh, excuse me. I've got the wrong card. Mr. Jensen?
Yes, sir. May it please the Court, my name is Steve Jensen, and I'm here on behalf of Joanne Schultz. In Kumho Tire v. Carmichael, Justice Breyer, writing for the Court, said that the district court's gatekeeping function under Daubert is limited to excluding testimony that, quote, falls outside the range where experts might reasonably differ, close quote. The Kumho Court also reinforced that the aim of the Daubert gatekeeping inquiry is to ensure that the testifying expert, quote, employs in the courtroom the same level of intellectual rigor that characterizes the practice of an expert in the relevant field. And this court recently in the Lapsley decision reinforced and embraced these sort of black letter principles from Kumho Tire. But in this case, the district court ignored those black letter principles and instead substituted its own scientific judgment or that of the defendant's experts for the scientific judgment of plaintiff's expert on causation, Dr. Stephen Gore. In so doing, the district court misapplied the Daubert framework and committed exactly the type of error that recently led the First Circuit in the Millward case to reverse the district court's exclusion of an expert in a benzene products liability case that is quite similar to this one. By second-guessing Dr. Gore on matters that fall within the range where experts can reasonably differ, the district court...
Why don't you list the two or three things that you feel were the specific mistakes made by the...
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think there are six.
I didn't mean to limit you. I just get a start on this.
And, so you know, after two or three, he loses interest, but go ahead.
And you could group them differently than I have. But I think one was that the district court adopted the defendant's expert's view of how much benzene exposure is necessary to cause acute myelogenous leukemia.
In part per million years, you mean?
Exactly. The district court said... Dr. Pyatt says that it is the consensus view of scientists that at least 40 part per million years is necessary in order to cause AML, and he just accepts that. The district court essentially accepts that as being the truth, when in fact not only is Dr. Gore's opinion different than that, but the record contains statistically significant peer-reviewed published epidemiological data showing that at 8 part per million years, there's an increased risk of AML, at least in among Australian petroleum workers, of 7 times increased risk.
What would be the minimum allowable under Dr. Gore's approach?
The minimum allowable exposure...
He represents, Mr. Jensen, as to be considered by the court.
Right. So... Let me answer that in a couple of different ways. As my briefs point out, Dr. Gore's analysis is supportable under three different independent sort of frameworks of analysis. One is that he looked at a quantified estimate, a reliable quantified estimate by a certified industrial hygienist of what Mr. Schultz's occupational exposures to benzene were, and he compared those numbers with numbers that have been shown in the epidemiological literature to increase the risk of AML specifically. And what he found was that Mr. Schultz's exposures were more than 3 times as high as what in the GLASS study was found to create a 7-fold increase in risk of AML. That is, 8 part per million years or more in the GLASS study was sufficient to increase AML risk 7-fold. Whereas Mr. Schultz's estimated benzene exposures in this case were 24 part per million years. And so that analysis standing alone is sufficient to support Dr. Gore's opinion. Dr. Gore's opinion also could stand as a result of his differential diagnosis slash differential etiology analysis, which does not, as a matter of law, a majority of federal courts have found, require the quantified estimate of a toxic exposure in order to rule in a toxin as a source of the disease.
So he rules in two things, right? He rules in the benzene exposure and the smoking.
Exactly.
And rules out any other factor that comes out.
Correct.
Of this health history. So I think maybe where we're getting is the fact that the defendants argue this very much on the so-called no threshold basis. And there's some concern about becoming an insurer of everybody who's ever walked past a molecule of benzene if that were the approach. Is that something you're standing on at this point?
Well, I'm not standing on the concept that anyone who walks, you know, through the air, which this courtroom, if you had sufficiently sensitive detection equipment, you'd find benzene in it. And I'm not suggesting that everyone in the country or that Dr. Gore's opinion for certain is that everyone in the country has a benzene-related leukemia merely by the fact that they've got background-level exposures. But what I do think is a third independent basis to support Dr. Gore's opinion is that because it is his view based on a weight of the evidence assessment of the full body of epidemiological and toxicological literature relating to benzene exposure and also relating to exposures to ionizing radiation and chemotherapy, which are also agents that can and do cause acute myeloid leukemia, and all the research that Dr. Gore has done and published on stem cells and how leukemias develop from a cell biology standpoint, it is his view that the weight of the evidence is that there is no safe threshold of exposure below which benzene doesn't increase risk. Now, how does he approach that in his, and this is what I think is critical for this court, how does he approach that in his everyday clinical practice as a hematologist-oncologist when he treats patients, which he does on a weekly basis? And what Dr. Gore does with his patients is in every instance where he has a leukemia patient, he does an occupational history and he tries to assess and makes an assessment whether or not any occupational exposures, including exposures to benzene, played a role in the determination of their leukemia. And he does that, and the record reflects that he does that for an important medical reason, which is that if, in fact, it is an occupationally related leukemia, that can make a difference for treatment protocols. So this is something he does ordinarily in his everyday practice.
So his view is that benzene damages these hematopoietic cells. Right.
Right. But and let me, if I might, just finish where he goes with his clinical evaluation, Your Honor, which is that his point of view is qualitative assessment of exposure in light of the fact that there is likely no safe threshold is sufficient to make a determination from his point of view as a clinical physician who wants to make a causation determination. Is sufficient, qualitative assessment of exposure is sufficient, and what he's trying to sort out is whether this person, this patient, has had a non-trivial, significant, toxicologically significant exposure to benzene.
Well, so that's important, and let me interrupt at this point and ask you whether this case is governed by Wisconsin toxic tort law, or what law are you asserting as a substantive matter?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that as a choice of law matter, this case will be governed by Wisconsin law.
Okay. That was actually surprisingly unclear in the record.
I think there's a statement in our reply brief about that, but I agree there's very little discussion about that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there has to be some significant level, and I guess that's where maybe you go back to the eight times as much risk or whatever these other things about Dr. Gore's testimony.
Well, right. In this case, since we've got quantitative estimates, you know, it's somewhat of a moot point as far as I'm concerned whether or not, you know, where the line could be drawn in a hypothetical qualitative assessment exposure case. But I do think that the record supports the inference that Dr. Gore believes, because the weight of the evidence shows there is no safe threshold, that if you qualitatively have someone who has a significant occupational exposure to petroleum solvents, which historically have been known to contain some levels of benzene, that Dr. Gore views that as a case that likely, if you've got AML and you've had an occupational history of exposure to petroleum solvents, that's probably going to be a case that Dr. Gore is going to fall on the side of, yes, those exposures to benzene in those solvents probably contributed to the disease.
Is there anything different in Dr. Gore's methodology in coming to these results, or the kind of literature he looks at and the methodology and the literature of the defendant's experts?
Well, methodology is a little bit different with respect to what I would describe as general causation issues, and there are a couple of what I would consider general causation issues that are embedded in this case, as opposed to the specific causation, which is application to the individual patient. What I think are the general causation issues in this case are how much benzene exposure does it take? And you gather that by reviewing all of the epidemiological and other literature that relates to benzene and leukemia, and especially acute myelogenous leukemia generally. Another issue that I would describe as a general causation issue is whether exposures more than 15 years prior to diagnosis, the latency issue.
The latency period, yeah.
Yes. What's the latency period that matters? How long can it be? Should it be considered? Those two are general causation issues. And Dr. Gore's methodology is a weight of the evidence methodology, which I think, as the Millward Court describes, is the way that general causation scientists can and do perform general causation. And I don't think that either Dr. Pyatt or Dr. Lichtman approached that any differently. They just reached different inferences and conclusions based on the same kind of review.
So bottom line, your position is it should have come in and then all the rest of this stuff should have gone to the weight.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And to go back to your initial question, so the six items were, you know, adopting defendant's expert's view of how much benzene exposure is necessary, adopting defendant's expert's view of whether benzene exposures more than 15 years prior to diagnosis can cause or contribute to the disease, throwing out Dr. Gore's opinions that were based on epidemiological literature because he also has the opinion that there's no safe threshold, failing to analyze or consider any of Dr. Gore's reasons in support of the conclusion that benzene exposures more than 15 years prior to diagnosis can cause AML.
You're into your rebuttal argument, you know.
I just recognize that. Thank you for reminding me. And unless the court has other questions, I will reserve the remainder of my argument.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Mr. Rattan?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Mark Rattan. I represent Akzo Nobel Paints, LLC, formerly known as the Glidden Company. I want to start by talking about Daubert law as it applies to benzene cases. We all know the Daubert rules. I'm not going to trouble us with those. But what has happened with various areas, whether it's asbestos or whether it's DES or whether it's benzene, Daubert has been further refined by one decision after another after another, to the point where
it actually probably shouldn't even be called that, because the Rules Committee codified what it wanted in Rule 702, but I will just make that point.
But I guess in the meantime, courts have issues come before them, and they have to sort of
courts talk about Daubert, but actually if you look at the Supreme Court's decision, this is governed by federal, I'm sure you must agree, Federal Rule of Evidence 702.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think this court is so held, as other courts have too.
You know, the district court here really didn't go through a particularly rigorous analysis and explain how it was applying Rule 702 to this situation, which concerns me actually quite a bit.
I believe it did, Your Honor.
Well, I'm looking at the opinion.
It followed the Daubert framework, and then it went into the benzene cases that have applied Daubert and benzene cases in Rule 702.
But why are what a few district courts say particularly helpful scientifically I mean, there's nothing that I can find too different in Dr. Gore's methodologies. And the fact that Dr. Gore classifies benzene in the group of substances for which science hasn't yet found a safe threshold. I mean, you know, you could put cyanide in there, too. You could probably put plutonium in there, too. You could put a number of things that no matter how low the dose, we really haven't yet found something. You might even put lead in there. There's some things that we just don't know, but that really seems to me such a sidelight, given the fact that there's evidence that the district court just brushes off of actual exposure that this man had that raised his risk in this doctor's opinion. You know, whether the doctor's right or not, whether the jury would want to believe your experts being a different issue.
But, Your Honor, I don't think you can conflate lead, radiation, asbestos, some of the other things you mentioned.
Sure I can, because you're saying that the concept of a no threshold is flawed, and I'm saying no. Whether benzene belongs there or not is a completely different issue. I agree with you. There's some things that belong there and some things that don't. There's nothing wrong with the concept, number one. And number two, whether benzene is something like that seems to me utterly beside the point in this case, given the evidence that Dr. Gore testified to, that this particular man had a far greater than negligible exposure in parts per million years.
I'm not sure that I'm tracking with the question. Are you saying that there
I'm
should
saying,
be a threshold?
I'm saying, why did the district court obsess about the, well, I'm looking at page 8 of its opinion. Schultz argues Dr. Gore does not exclusively rely on a no-threshold theory, and the judge just brushes that off, and I don't think pays any attention to Dr. Gore's opinions about the actual exposures and the 8 parts per million and all the rest of it.
Because I think the district court was correct, and it was a correct exercise of discretion.
But there's no explanation.
Well, the explanation is, and I think he cited a couple of the cases, is every benzene case, every benzene exposure case has required a threshold. And if it didn't, then the
expert
wasn't.
And Dr. Gore testifies to a threshold. We have this one paragraph where the district court thinks that Dr. Gore is disingenuously arguing something in the alternative. But what's wrong with an expert saying, actually, in my opinion, there's no safe threshold, but if you get up to 8 part per million years or 16 part per million years, and this man's at 24, let's assume there's a threshold. His risk is way higher.
That's where I respectfully disagree with the court, because I don't think the record shows that Dr. Gore ever stated a threshold. He threw some articles in a footnote to a brief that talked about 8 parts per million increasing risk, but
and
he didn't.
May I remind you that Dr. Gore did not say anything about no threshold in his expert report. That came up as an answer in a question in his deposition. So that wasn't part of his expert report anyway.
Well, it's what the courts have called his theory. The courts have adopted that term to describe his theory.
But if it isn't his theory, if it's not the theory he expresses in the report, why are you inflicting it on him?
Because it is his theory.
No, it wasn't.
Well, I believe it was, because it was non-trivial. He says any non-trivial exposure, but with what does that mean?
But he's talking about a man. He testifies in his report and in his deposition that if you're exposed to 24 part per million years, your risk of developing acute myelogenous leukemia is substantially higher. He gives percentages than the general population.
Right, he discussed risk.
So you're trying to make this be a case that I think it isn't. If he had said, you know, he worked for one day painting with benzene, with our paints, and that's enough, that would be the case that I think would be a strong one for you. But that's not this case.
Well, actually, I believe it is, because he never comes up with a number or a threshold beyond which you are more likely than not to get leukemia.
I disagree with that. I think he looks at these studies and he says, you know, 8 part per million years, 16, 24, have led to 8 times the general population risk or much more than the general population, which would take care of the background benzene that we're all exposed to.
Except, again, he falls back on non-trivial exposure as being the benchmark.
And well, I don't see that, to be honest. We can all sit here and read his report and his deposition, but I frankly don't see that.
I believe he clearly does, and part of the reason he does is because, as the district court pointed out but didn't rule on, they also have a problem with their exposure expert and his numbers. But he cites a lot of articles of which he never presented to the district court and throws a lot of numbers around, but he never comes up with a number that is a threshold. So under his theory, somebody could work in a gas station for a summer job when he's 18 and be exposed to benzene, quote, non-trivial. Again, we're not sure what that
but
means.
But you're dealing with a hypothetical case. This is a man who works for something like 6 years around benzene, and they compute 24 ultimately after the various corrections, right? It starts out at like 36 or something, goes down to 24. So I don't know why you want us to decide this case on the basis of hypotheticals as opposed to on the basis of the actual evidence.
Because there's no actual evidence. Because the law requires a threshold, and there's no actual evidence
why
of
is
a
the
threshold
law,
or that he crossed it.
Where does the law I don't want to get off into this because I really don't think it's this case. The law does not require a threshold unless there is one. So if it were plutonium, for example, you wouldn't say the law requires a threshold. It's a substance-specific issue.
Precisely. And in the benzene cases, the Sixth Circuit...
Why does 40 parts per million years take on this magic quality instead of 24? Isn't that an issue for the jury to decide, whether it's 40 or 24?
No, because Dr. Gore is not endorsing 24 either. He's not
He's
accepting
saying
24
any level. Is enough, right? You wouldn't disagree with that.
That 24 is enough?
Yeah. He says 24 is enough. And he has studies that show that the risk for people exposed to 24 ppm years is greatly enhanced over that of the general population.
But that's
these
all
Chinese studies, the other studies.
Well, as we point out in our brief, first of all, a number of courts have already rejected some of those studies that.
But they're not us. You know, there are some district courts who, you know, we get to look at this.
All right. But you're saying that he says 24 is enough.
Yeah.
Okay.
His testimony is that this particular man, Mr. Schultz, was exposed to enough benzene from the paints greatly to enhance his risk of developing AML.
Okay, but according to the studies you mentioned, he'd also say 8 is enough.
So what? Mr. Schultz wasn't exposed to 8.
Because the point of Daubert and the benzene cases that construe Daubert is that how
so
you...
Let me make the point this way. Suppose Dr. Gore testified that Mr. Schultz, as far as he could tell, was exposed to 100 ppm years, but he holds the view that there is actually no minimum. You would still say, well, that's not enough either, because 100 ppm years from somebody who thinks that 10 is enough is meaningless evidence. That's crazy.
We're not dealing with 100 ppm in this
case. But we are dealing with 24.
Maybe. But I go back to...
So that's why I'm saying you can't disregard the actual number, because if you don't want to say that you disregard his testimony if it was 100.
No, I think if he said it's 100 ppm, that is a recognized...
But suppose a man who believes, as Dr. Gore does, that very low levels are also a problem, says... Nonetheless, 100 is enough. You want to get rid of that evidence simply because he holds the view that something much less would be enough, too. And I'm saying that's wrong.
I respectfully disagree, because every other court, including the Sixth Circuit, that have looked at this have said, no, with benzene, there has to be a threshold. And the whole point of Daubert is if it's not scientifically reliable, how do you defend against it? How do you cross-examine? He says 24 is enough. He might say 8 is enough. He might you know, say one is
so
enough.
So you attack on 24. Your experts come in and say it has to be 40, and people with 24 don't have any bigger risk than the general population, if you can get somebody to say that.
Right, but then it becomes
that's a weight. That's a weight issue. It's not an admissibility issue.
Well, no, I think it's clearly an admissibility issue because the courts, with certain substances, including benzene, do require thresholds. Okay. They also require, in addition to that, ruling out other causes. And what we have here is the opposite, is Dr. Gore has ruled in another cause.
Look, the courts do not require, even in pneumoconiosis cases, all kinds of cases, single causation. Dr. Gore thinks there are two causes for this man's AML, the smoking and the benzene. He doesn't think there are a million causes. It's two. That's why I asked about the substantive law. I don't know what Wisconsin does when they're dual causation. Some of the hematopoietic cells may have been damaged from benzene. Some of them may have been damaged from the smoking. You know, maybe Wisconsin law lets you off the hook on that.
Well, except that we're not dealing with Wisconsin law. And I think you pointed out in counsel's argument that, and he admitted, nothing was brought up about anything other than Daubert and the federal rule of evidence applying here until their reply brief.
But how can you, I mean, the applicable law sets the standards for the relevance of the evidence. What law do you think applies?
Federal rule of evidence 702
and
Daubert.
No, on the substance, on what's going to make or break this plaintiff's case. Is this a Wisconsin case? Is it a Florida case? Is it a... What? It's certainly not federal law.
The federal rules of evidence and Daubert control, and they do make the decision here.
But it has to be relevant to an element that's in the case. 702 is tied to the underlying legal elements of the case.
Here's your chance to take advantage of the red light and sit down.
Thank you.
As you wish. The risk of that is that I will consider the question unanswered.
Oh, no, you should respond. If you wish to respond, you should respond.
I was just giving you a way out.
And the question is?
Why do you think 702 doesn't relate to the legal elements of the case that the party is presenting?
Because, and it's cited in their briefs and ours, every case that has looked at either a state law or Rule 702 when it comes to expert testimony in a chemical exposure case has said Rule 702 and the case law decided under Daubert is the controlling. The In Re Paoli case, I believe there's a Seventh Circuit decision on that. Every case that has looked at this in these toxic tort exposure cases, it said that Rule 702 applies.
Okay, I get that. What I'm focusing on is to understand the evidence or to determine a fact in issue. And a fact is not going to be an issue unless the substantive law governing the case makes that fact in issue. That's my point.
Right, but 702 and Daubert still control that issue.
Oh, of course. I mean, look, you know, no dispute here about which evidence rules apply in federal court, but...
And those rules...
The elements come, in this particular case, I believe, from state law. This isn't a federal case, is it? It doesn't arise under federal law.
Well, that's a tricky question because it actually does involve federal law. We're in federal courts.
It's a diversity case. It's a diversity case, and whether... That's why I'm asking about Wisconsin law, because if Wisconsin law requires a single cause for all torts, that would be one thing. If Wisconsin law has comparative negligence, that would be another thing. If Wisconsin law requires, you know, doesn't even have strict liability, you would win probably automatically. I mean, there are a lot of things that are quite relevant about the law that provides the cause of action.
And that's where I respectfully disagree with you, because the Paoli case, for one, expressly rejected the notion that state substantive law trumps the federal rules of evidence or Daubert.
It's not a question of trumping. It's a question of defining relevance. That's all. No, never mind. We're obviously not communicating, so that's okay.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rattan. Mr. Braithwaite?
I didn't realize
Well, I thought you were requesting 2 minutes.
Attorney Rattan had used my 2 minutes, but if I have 2 minutes, I'll take it. May it please the Court, Attorney Ryan Braithwaite on behalf of Duraco Paint and Color Corporation. Duraco is kind of caught up in this case for, frankly, no good reason. And as we indicated in our brief, there is absolutely no evidence of exposure to a Duraco product. And as a result, we think that we should properly be dismissed. Now, the Court granted our motion but didn't address any of the substantive grounds, essentially holding that the Daubert analysis applied to all claims, which is correct. We would adopt those arguments, but as it comes to Duraco, I think even though the lower court has not ruled on this motion, there is no dispute of fact. The law is quite clear. The parties are in precise agreement as to what the basis for the claim is against Duraco. And it's an affidavit from an expert that contains a hearsay account of a telephone conversation with a coworker. There's no affidavit from the coworker. There's no deposition testimony from the coworker. And you can't create evidence by putting it in an affidavit of an expert. And so on that basis, the claims against Duraco fall. Now, today it sounded like the plaintiff for the first time, or appellant in this case, conceded essentially, there's a threshold, and they're relying on the 8 parts per million analysis. According to plaintiff's own experts, the combined exposure from all of Duraco, as well as Glidden, in the only area that's relevant to Duraco, which is the painting of these yellow safety guardrails, combined from both sources, with no attempt to apportion it, is 0.6 to 0.7 parts per million years. Now, that number's got a lot of problems, but from what I've heard today, I would say we should also win on a threshold analysis because there's absolutely no evidence to support the notion that a 0.6 to 0.7 shared exposure between two companies is enough to say that one company is a cause. And that would assume that we had evidence of exposure to a Duraco product, but we do not. Thank you.
Mr. Jensen?
Thank you. I'd like to address Judge Wood's concerns about substantive law. And I would point to the reply brief at page 22 and footnote 6 of the reply brief, which discusses this issue. It is a diversity case. Mr. Schultz's exposures were entirely in the state of Wisconsin, and we believe under applicable choice of law principles and Wisconsin choice of law principles, Wisconsin substantive law will govern the issue. And then as the reply brief points out, under the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision in Clark versus Leisure Vehicles, Inc. at 292 Northwest 2nd, 630, the court said, quote, there may be several substantial factors contributing to the same result. That is Wisconsin's substantive law of causation, that you can have multiple factors that contribute to a particular occurrence injury result in a tort case.
And so under Federal Rule of Evidence 401, the test for relevant evidence, the existence of multiple causes would be of consequence. The way it says is the fact is of consequence in determining the action. It makes multiple causation of consequence.
Right. And as we argued in the reply brief, Your Honor, the way the district court reasoned with respect to saying that Dr. Gore's responsibility as a matter of law was to rule out all causes other than benzene, and that if there was any other cause that Dr. Gore thought was contributed, he's had an unreliable diagnosis as a matter of law or etiology analysis as a matter of law. That application of Rule 702, we argue, would be a violation of the Rules Enabling Act, because he would be essentially saying that he would be abridging or modifying Wisconsin's substantive law by holding that there has to be one and only one cause of the injury established by the plaintiff. He'd be changing the plaintiff's burden of proof under Wisconsin law. I want to briefly address the Duraco argument by Mr. Brathwaite. Dr. Stewart's affidavit is substantive, reliable evidence of exposure to Duraco products. Dr. Stewart relied on his interviews with a coworker, which is the kind of evidence that a certified industrial hygienist, easy for me to say, assessing exposure can and do rely on, reasonably rely on.
Bart's representations as to the level?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know candidly off the top of my head whether the level that's specific to Duraco was accurately stated by Mr. Brathwaite. What I do know is...
Well, what does the record reflect? I reference it because he spoke to us.
Well, I think he's right about the Duraco-specific benzene exposure. I'm not certain as I stand here, but I think that he's right about that. I would say two things. Most importantly, number one, that was not at all part of the motion by Duraco in the district court. Not only was it not ruled on, Duraco's motion wasn't explicitly ruled on in any event, but that was not part of Duraco's motion. And number two, to address the merits of that argument, the key aspect here is whether the cumulative occupational benzene exposures were sufficient to cause Mr. Schultz's AML. If the cumulative exposures were sufficient, then the record supports, and Dr. Gore's opinion reflects, that every occupational exposure that was part of that cumulative exposure is a contributor to the disease. And so the fact that Duraco's exposure standing alone, if all of his exposure had just been that exposure, the record's unclear, but it might well be that Dr. Gore would say that's not enough. But when the Duraco exposures are part of a cumulative total, that is more.
So Duraco should be in this suit. How about a tobacco company? Did you reflect upon whether they ought to be joined too?
Well, certainly we made a strategic/tactical decision that we didn't want to do that. Whether the defendants want to bring them in as a
Duraco with its prescribed contribution, but not. A tobacco company, which is, I guess, even Dr. Gore recognizes a potentially significant contributor to this situation.
Well, Your Honor,
your judgment call is your judgment call.
Right.
But it stands in a little bit of a contrast, doesn't it, to when you're thinking about liability issues, who's responsible in these kinds of settings?
From a causation perspective, Dr. Gore believes that smoking contributed, and we don't run away from that, Your Honor. Having said that, the decision of, you know, which case we want to bring is a tactical one that the lawyers have made.
I understand.
All right. So, for all these reasons.
Can conclude.
Okay. Well, the district court went far beyond its role as a gatekeeper and stepped into the role of the jury. The court should reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court